Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, school choice and the Supreme Court. And Richard, the Supreme Court recently heard arguments in a case out of Montana. Could have big implications for the future of school choice. The state had enacted a program. This is a model you sometimes see in states that are trying to expand school choice, where it was offering tax credits, fairly modest ones actually, for individuals who were donating to a scholarship fund. That fund would then distribute that money to help students pay private school tuition, including at religious schools, which is the flashpoint here. So the Montana Department of Revenue shut the program down because it ran afoul of a prohibition in the state constitution there against public funds being used to aid churches or religious schools. This is what's known as a Blaine Amendment. So why don't we actually start there, Richard? These Blaine Amendments exist in about three quarters of the states. In fact, they were actually implemented at the state level after failing to make it as a federal constitutional amendment back in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. There has long been an urge amongst conservatives and libertarians to get these things eviscerated in the courts. How good of a case for that is there on the merits?
Well, the case has already been accepted on the merits, at least in one form, in an earlier case involving the Trinity Lutheran Church. Let me just read the Blaine Amendment so people could understand what its breadth is. That no money shall ever be taken from the public treasury, directly or indirectly, so that covers your tax program, in aid of any church, sect, or denominational religion, or in aid of any priest, preacher, minister, or teacher thereof as such, and that no preference shall be given to nor any discrimination made against any church, sect, or creed of religion or of any form of religious faith or worship. So essentially, it looks as though it's going to be what happens is you can't discriminate against them, but you can't discriminate them for them. And in this earlier case involving Lutheran General, what you did is you had a program that was put into full effect. And in the course of that particular program, people were applying for various benefits to improve their schools. And the Lutheran Church wanted to have some of those benefits. And they scored very well on the abstract test. And then the entire grant was negated on the grounds that the aid that you got from it was inconsistent with the Blaine Amendment. It was held in the Supreme Court that we're not going to mess with the question of whether or not the Blaine Amendment does or does not cover this. That's a question of state law, plausibly rendered. But they said, given the fact that you are now going to select out from the religious institutions and give it to everybody else, what you have here is essentially an impermissible discrimination between religious and non-religious organization that runs afoul of the Federal Establishment Clause. And so, therefore, what we do is we're going to knock this thing down. You could also think of this to some extent as a free exercise kind of case. Can you condition your ability to operate as a church on your unwillingness to take benefits that are going to be given to other organizations, which in every other respect are close substitutes for your own? There was a division of opinion. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the case, and it turned out that we now know that selective exclusion of religious bodies from this particular thing under the Blaine Amendment is inconsistent with the First Amendment. This case, of course, is a little bit different because you had the program, and then the moment somebody saw the whiff of the unconstitutionality, what they did is they removed the entire program. I believe it was done by the taxing authorities, and that decision was ratified by the Montana court.
Right. I think it's the revenue department that was responsible for the original decision. And this does bring up an interesting point. I mean, we generally try to steer away from too much process here, but in this case, this question is relevant. The plaintiff in this case is the parent of children who weren't able to receive the scholarship money. But it's worth reminding our audience that the parents don't receive the money directly from the state. They receive it from the school, who's received it from the donor, who's contributed to the scholarship fund, who in turn would have received the tax credit. So there was some skepticism, especially from the liberal justices, that there was enough of a nexus there to even give the parents standing in this lawsuit. How serious a prospect is there that this case gets stymied because of the standing issue?
I regard it as a very serious question. The way in which the point was put by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she said, look, We understand from the earlier decisions that you can't give it to non-religious people and keep it from religious people, so you have to level. She says they're now entitled to level up or to level down, and if they decide to level down and you get nothing, you can't complain because the injury that you suffered would have to be from the differential application. And it doesn't help that all the benefits that you get from contributions that people make to these funds that are then applied to your particular students. So what she did is she made essentially an argument that there was no differential treatment. And then she made an argument that instead of having a direct connection, it was a remote connection. And how do you start to deal with it is actually very, very tricky, because you start with the assumption that suppose the legislature had a little bit more foresight, and what it had done was simply decided not to pass this amendment and give aid to anybody, because it would rather have a situation in which nobody got aid than everybody got aid. I don't think there's a chance in the world that somebody could go forward and saying the only reason why it is that you took this no assistant position is you did not want to yoke religious to non-religious schools, and so therefore they have to put the program in place. That certainly can't be done under these circumstances, particularly if what you're trying to do is to put a program into place and then have to figure out all the terms and conditions, the size of the grants, all the participants, the conditions and limitations. Not going to happen. The argument on the other side is, hey, you already had this program into place, and you knew exactly how to do it. So it's not a question of figuring out how we fashion this thing. And now what you do is you get an administrative agency. When that decides is it doesn't want to enforce the particular program, and that's something which arguably is beyond its particular scope. So we have to treat them as though they did enforce the particular program or give it into place. Now, in effect, you get the differential result if we're excluded under the statute and everybody else is in, so you can't do it. Now, this is an argument on either side that just doesn't appeal deeply to somebody's built-in sense of equity, given all of the second-best assumptions that you have to make. And so, you know, the three feminine justices, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Ginsburg, were pushing very hard on that. The Gorsuch and the Alitos of this world, the two of them, were basically quite in favor of the Lutheran general type or Lutheran church type decision. And their tendency was to say what you do is you look at the statute and you ignore the subsequent administrative stuff. Very much a second order question, given the reasons that I've said. So I think, in fact, the cases in limbo, you get somebody in the middle like the Chief Justice, and he's always been some kind of an institutionalist, whatever that phrase means. It includes the possibility of trying to duck hard issues when it turns out that you've got a respectable out from them. And it is certainly more than a respectable out to say if they didn't have to enact it in the first place, they're okay if they decide not to reinforce it, even if it's an administrator rather than the legislator itself that decided to make this opinion. So I think really what you're doing is you're seeing yet another chapter in the very troubled relationships of the history in church and state. And that's a history which goes back at least to a case called Everson, way back right after the first, or after the Second World War.
If a Justice Epstein was on the bench, how would he be inclined to handle this case?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I have to really think very hard. I think the point that leveling down is permissible is there. And then the question what you have to ask, I think, is do you believe that when the administrative agency decided not to enforce it, the Department of Revenue, was it acting ultra vires or was it not? That is beyond its power. And if you come up with the conclusion that an agency is duty-bound not to enforce the statute under these circumstances and therefore chooses not to do it, then in effect it strikes me that it's not being an illegal act. It's an act in which you decide not to enforce an unconstitutional statute. We've had other cases in which raise this problem, and one of them involves the city of Jackson, Mississippi, in around 1963, just before the advent of the civil rights thing, and there was a public pool. And what happened was the federal court said, you have to integrate this particular pool. You cannot make it whites only. And so what did the worthy citizens of Mississippi did? They shut it down. And then the question was whether or not you were duty-bound to open this thing up in order to take the benefit of this to everybody. And I think it was Justice Black. But the Supreme Court said, no, you're not allowed to discriminate, but you're not obligated to serve. And so if that kind of precedent starts to take hold in here, then it seems to me that what you're going to see is the justices on the dissent don't do it. Now, it's also, by the way, this is another kind of difficulty with this. Justice Epstein comes along, this is not going to happen, and he decides that these people are entitled to it. Can you then frame your decree so that everybody else who's not part of a religious organization also gets the benefit of the statute? In other words, you have to reinflate the lifeboat so that everybody gets in it, or you just give the relief with respect to the one party. Reinflating the lifeboat is the odd sense of changing the rights and duties of strangers. Just doing it for these people creates the very kind of invidious discrimination that the Establishment Clause is designed to prevent. And so if you have to make that choice upon all the other choices, it's at least plausible that this thing is going to be dismissed on those kinds of grounds. I don't think anybody was particularly comfortable with the way this went. There was a nice commentary on the SCOTUS block by Amy Howe, and you know, she essentially laid it all out and said, in the end, there are a couple of justices in the middle, and Lord knows which way they are going to go. So I think you could say, given the delicacy of the question and the importance of the interest, it's going to go one way or another if, in fact, they invalidate this particular restriction and keep the statute and allow the religious groups to get in. It's going to be a revolution in the way in which states do these programs, and they're going to go small rather than going big because they don't want to get themselves into the position where the next case comes along, you put something up, you get an adverse judgment, and then it's the legislature as opposed to the administrative agency which says, we're taking this all back. And the question is, once committed, is it become irrevocable? Whereas every other statute, generally speaking, you can repeal and go to the status quo ante. So I think in the end, this probably is somewhat better than even chance that I would decide the case in line with the dissents in this particular situation. I think the one thing you have to condemn is the differential treatment, and that by definition is excluded from this case.
Let me ask you about some of the other policy issues swirling around issues of school choice right now. Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, big proponent of school choice, and she's proposed on behalf of the Trump administration a $5 billion tax credit program where money would flow from the federal government to the states for these kinds of scholarships. But it'd be voluntary for states to participate, and they could define their own eligibility criteria. So you have these competing impulses where conservatives have traditionally been hesitant to involve the federal government in education policy, made the argument that it's, you know, rightfully the purview of the state and local governments. But they're also trying to capitalize on having the levers of federal power. How do you react to this attempt to sort of fuse those two instincts?
I mean, I'm not a fan of having the federal government inject huge amounts of money into the state system, and I'm not a fan of having them do it on a quote-unquote voluntary basis. Let's suppose you have a state which, like Montana, is genuinely opposed to these things and doesn't want to do it. Well, the part of the federal money now remains constant, and now these dollars are going to go to somebody else in another state which has fewer scruples about that particular issue. So this is a little bit about some of these Medicare programs, if you recall, under the Affordable Care Act, where if you wanted to take the program, you could take it, and if you didn't want to take it, you would still be taxed, and the money would go off to somebody else. I regard that as a dangerous situation. So I think in the end, I'm against this kind of situation and would rather have these programs generated by the states out of their own fund. I'm also, in general, very unhappy about trying to get the federal government get a larger role with respect to education. And if you're committed for this on a structural reason that states are better off working as self-contained entities, the last thing you want to do is to make an exception to it when your friends and your neighbors and your buddies decide to take a huge dollop of federal funds and to put them into a set of programs that are going to give rise to very contentious divisions within the state. So I'm against doing that kind of thing. I mean, what I'm really in favor of in all of these particular cases is to have a system in which if you want to opt out of the public school system and provide your children with an education, what we do is we have a kind of a rule which says we figure out what your taxes are, and the moment you defray the government some fraction of the taxes, your real estate taxes, essentially, to the extent that they're dedicated to this program, are going to be erased. So what you do is you get a relatively automatic type situation to move in that particular direction. I mean, I do think it's extremely important in these cases that you start to break the state monopoly over education through the public school system, and a system of implicit tax subsidies will do it. I also think, and this has been a long line of cases, that in general, if you start giving money to students, and they could then spend it in religious or non-religious institutions, so long as everybody has an equal option, I don't care which way the options are exercised. So if people want to take vouchers and use them mainly in religious schools, so be it, particularly if you're going to make some adjustments in virtue of the fact that the public funds that now have to go to public education are going to be reduced. I think when you run any of these programs, I don't think it's correct to say that they're all illicit because they, quote unquote, subsidize religion. It's a two-way street. If it turns out that religious people are excluded from these programs and have to pay taxes, then they're subsidizing non-religious kinds of people. And I don't think that that's particularly good as well. Generally speaking, I want a smaller federal government on this stuff. If I had my druthers with respect to the states, they would probably cut back on all of their educational situations so that you get a greater reliance on first-party funds in these cases. That's not going to happen, at least in the short run. So I think, in effect, that the smallest involvement that we get in the federal government and the lowest level of favoritism that we get in the state government, you have a chance of improving things, which is why I tend to like home education and vouchers.
So let me close then on a philosophical question, because one of the concerns you always run up against when you talk about educational pluralism, especially as regards religious schools, is where you set the outer bounds. So, for instance, if there's support for kids to go to religious schools, are you going to let funds flow to an Islamic school that functions as a madrasa or to an evangelical school that is supporting white supremacy? And so I'm understood clearly. I don't take either of those hypotheticals to be representative of the mainstream of those faiths, but the whole point here is that we're talking about edge cases. How does a libertarian like yourself think about the limits on that?
Well, this is basically a rerun of the Bob Jones case. And in Bob Jones, what they said is, we will deny the charitable deduction to any particular institution that prohibits interracial dating. And what had happened, of course, is if there were no subsidy involved in this particular case, it would be an infringement on freedom of religion to have a direct prohibition on any school making that as a condition for entry, because it would interfere with the freedom and exercise. My own view is that whenever you start putting taxes in there, it's exactly the same principle as applies elsewhere, on the simple ground that the moment you exclude one group because you find their behavior is obnoxious, what happens is that you then, under these circumstances, are necessarily subsidizing the other. So then the question is, does this go the whole nine yards? And I think the answer comes, let's suppose we have one of these schools, a madras or a yeshiva, whatever it is, and what it does is it starts to breed race hatred of one form or another, which is in danger of leading to abuse of children or violence to other people. You don't need a tax subsidy in order to restrict that. These institutions essentially are very serious threats to the health and safety of the public, and you can regulate them in the first instance and in extreme cases shut them down. So if you can do it through direct regulation, then the caveat is that you could also do it by shutting down the spigot for giving them the money. And so what you have to do is to have a parity between the two systems, and when you do that, you realize that many forms of direct regulation of extreme and crazy religious institutions are in fact going to be justified on traditional police power grounds having to do with the health and safety of the community. I would have to think long and hard before I started to do that. But suppose you now find a case that there's somebody of X religion, and what they do is they have their students, and sure enough, they've gone out and they've committed arson against some other religious faith or committed some public forms of violence. At that particular point, cutting them out of the system strikes me as being not only possible, but probably desirable and indeed perhaps mandatory. So if you keep the parity between the two cases, I think what you do is you get the reasonable balance that you want to have. I don't want to have different rules for subsidies than I have for direct regulation.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.